sober. Oh, you've all gone dark now. It's great to be here again. And one of the things that I just wanted to start off with was just a little bit of congratulations for what's happening on this island. I was really, really lucky earlier on this year to go to a children's festival in the north of this island, in Belfast. And now coming here to Barborough, I think it's just a really, really wonderful, two fabulous examples of what children's festivals are and what they can be. And what they have at their heart is that thing of bringing in work and bringing in artists from different parts of the world so that your audiences, so people like us, so people from your land can actually see what artists are doing from different places and start to have that kind of discussion. And then what you've also got is you've got your homegrown work and that opportunity to put your artists side by side, these people that are coming from different parts of the world, to see your work in context with what's happening from different places, to have that chance to get together, to discuss and to reflect, but ultimately that thing to celebrate the work which is happening in your lands and also the work that's happening in other lands. And I think the festivals that you've got in your this island at the moment are just fabulous examples of that kind of work and that kind of festival. So congratulations to you both, and you're both directors are here today as well. So to Barborough and to Belfast, congratulations. So now I'm going to pass on to Jess.
Thank you.
Who's going to talk for a bit.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Aislinn. And thanks for having me. Welcome, everybody. So, yeah, the glasses. I'm at that age too. Can't look down. Yes, I won't see you. I'll just see my paper. So I'm an independent artist based in Melbourne, and I come from a theatre background, mainly spectacle and puppetry, but had, you know, a number of years in my past where I made works in theatres. And I have recently, over the last kind of 10 years, shifted gradually away from making work in theatres, because I've become much more interested in the kind of real people and the real places. And so my practice is very much about making works that involve real people and real places. So as we've all mentioned about the geographic isolation, Australia is such an extreme example of that. And because we're an island, we're, I suppose, even more compelled to, I think, collaborate and seek out people from other places and to understand ourselves and to exchange so that we feel more connected, I guess, with the world. But it's 24 hours or so to get to Europe, as you probably, or something like that. Is it 23, 22? It's a lot.
Too many.
A lot of hours in a plane, and a return flight Melbourne to London creates a warming effect equivalent, I'll quote this, to 16.8 tonnes of CO2 per passenger. Now, I've never quite understood exactly what that means, to be honest, because that seems like a lot of tonnes. But in any case, it's bad. And so before COVID, so of course as an artist there's such a tension, I guess, between that kind of desire to collaborate and extend and the kind of very real effect of the travel. So before COVID these numbers really shocked me, and I started to really and then as COVID came along and there was lots of time to reflect, I started to kind of really think about how to make my practice very much artistically and financially and CO2 wise more sustainable. And so I've developed a number of models that enable collaboration between international artists and between a very kind of localised sense of audience and participants with limited travel. So now I either travel alone without a team or freight, or I don't travel. I've managed to collaborate without travel. So I just wanted to chat about a couple of projects that are different kinds of models that I've developed. The first one is some of you have probably seen the exhibition of I See You Like This at the Galway Arts Centre, and this work slide. Oh, there it is. This work is essentially a way of... It's kind of like I bring a concept that I've tested that I know works, and it's the content is developed with local people, in this case children, making portraits on their parents' faces, and then there's a kind of high profile public outcome, a kind of high production value public outcome. And then I've made another work called The Wayfinders Slide, which is similarly, I have children recording the voices of trees and rubbish bins and footpaths in the sky and in a kind of tract of landscape, and then I situate those and have, using a beacon triggering system, a week or so later I have younger children travel around with headphones, and as they walk past the tree or the cup, it speaks to them in the voices that have come from the participative process. So these are kind of two models that I've developed, where I can travel without stuff and I can travel without people. I can pick up lots of local artists and work with local community and places to really make the work feel it's international, but it's still very localised. And then I've been working a little bit with just me as a lead artist, bringing in a concept and making the work in the place. This is a slide. This work here is called The Narrator, and I made it in Latvia in 2019, and I'd been already making works on buses a lot, and I decided to I was commissioned to make a new work on a bus in a small town in Latvia, and so I worked with children and local artists to develop this work across a period of 3 weeks, and then it I was able to then take it home and recite it in Australia. So I was able to make a new work without having to get any funding at home, which was cool. And essentially in this work, children kind of their own city is reframed as a different place through the windows of a bus. And the idea is that children are able to kind of see their own places as the sites for children's stories. And then lastly, I've been working, doing some collaborations where I don't travel at all. And specifically, I've been messing with type forms, like no-code forms, to create almost like a process where it feels like I'm in the room with individual participants, because their answers are reincorporated into a kind of creative conversation. And this project, Child Nation, is kind of based on that practice. It's kind of private and uninhibited creativity using participation. So this kind of segues me into the project I'm doing here. This kind of process of using digital forms as a almost like a brainstorming process, I've been using quite a bit in collaboration. So for this project for Child Nation, I worked with artists in Korea and Singapore and other places where we never actually met physically. We just collaborated on Zoom and we wrote these forms together, and then they were given to children locally and the answers come back to us, and we're able to kind of work using this kind of tech beyond the kind of Zoom contract. We're able to use this other tech. So when I started, when I was invited by Barbaro to work with Maisie Lee on The Shape of Quiet Feelings, we used these digital forms as a way to elicit the kind of children's feelings about climate change here in Galway and around Galway. And that kind of enabled that collaboration to have a different dimension, which was so awesome. So... I'm going to talk a bit on behalf of Maisie in a minute, but I just wanted to say that I'm kind of loving this kind of work because it's such an interesting way to really genuinely share with artists and audiences in this kind of hyper-international, hyper-local way. I'm very much appreciative for being here because the work that we've been doing here has been beautifully presented in the Galway Arts Centre and with The Shape of Quiet Feelings. It's really lovely to be here and see those things culminate.
But Maisie can't, unfortunately, be with us today. But she did pass on some notes, so I'm now going to pass back to Jess, who's going to do her best impersonation of Maisie.
I wish I could do an Irish accent by now.
That was perfect.
She's not even Irish. That was perfect.
Never.
Perfect. Is that it? Anyway, Maisie's actually Scottish, isn't she, I think? Anyway, so I'm speaking now as Maisie. I'm just going to read this. So I've been an artist in residence with Barbaro since 2021, and it helped to research, set up, and am now... Sorry, I helped to research, set up, and now am the lead artist with the Barbaro Children's Panel. So in 2021, Barbaro commissioned me to make Don't Forget to Wash Your Hands, a documentary exploring Galway's children's experiences of the pandemic. Following this, I wanted to do something that connected my work expressing children's thoughts and feelings, and I was really interested in talking to them about climate change. But I wanted the project to take a more creative and imaginative angle away from the kind of purely documentary style that I'd used with the other project. Barbaro were very supportive of this, and Ashlyn suggested connecting with Jessica Wilson, whose expertise in participatory work for children could really complement the idea. Enter me. Jessica came on board to co-conceive the idea of the piece with me and then to mentor the process as it came together. This was also a nice way of bringing together our own backgrounds and areas of interest, mine in putting together the final theatrical experience and Jess in refining the participatory part of the piece. After several conversations, our early thoughts evolved into the idea of asking children to imagine their feelings around climate change as creatures that I could somehow attempt to bring to life through recorded text, set and models, lighting and sound. So last autumn, we began brainstorming around these ideas and decided we needed to ask children a few questions to get us started. So I contacted the children's panel and asked who'd be interested in getting involved, and asked them to answer some questions for us. So the questions they answered were such as, when you hear the words climate change, what kind of feeling do you get? When you hear the word climate change, what colour does it evoke? What texture, etc.? And we turned these images into creatures. We then decided to use Jess's knowledge and experience of surveys through her Child Nation project to set up a series of surveys based around these questions and answers. This was a great way of spreading the net wide, and Jess and I both being involved in the initial research gathering despite being many miles apart. The initial answers then led to a second round of surveys digging slightly deeper into the answers that they had initially provided. From here, it was then narrowing and trying to get to the heart of the project. She means with the content that we gathered through the surveys. I did some in-person workshops and some recording with small groups of children in a school and with the children's panel who continued to be involved. At this point, the collaboration shifted as we began to have a better sense of the concept of the piece and I started to put the audio together. It was great to have Jess as an outside eye and dramaturg while I was editing and trying to put some order and shape into the children's ideas. Because of the nature of the project, the audio essentially being a script, it meant that even without being in the same country, Jess and I were able to both have access to the narrative journey as it would be experienced by audiences in the final piece. We could both listen to versions as we tried to find the right one without being in the same place, which would not have been possible if the project had used live voices. Ultimately, the process worked really well remotely in the way that it developed, beginning with the typeform surveys and then moving on to the audio narrative. Working digitally in this way, both for the process and the product, meant we were able to share the experience and work together on it over email and Zoom. And that's all. That's Maisie's, what Maisie has to say.
Thanks, Maisie.
So thank you, Maisie. Let's give her a clap. Yeah. So the project, The Shape of Quiet Feelings, was really, really the strongest part of that as an international collaboration on reflection was the early stage where we were working with the forms and working together over Zoom. And then Maisie was able to kind of take that into a collaboration with the local artists. So maybe we can talk about that a bit more later. But I thank you very much.
I'll pass you on to Andy now.
Thanks, Tony. Slingsby is a theatre company based in Adelaide on Garnamina country, Adelaide Plains in South Australia. And I would say that collaboration really is the fire in the belly of everything that Slingsby does. And hopefully as we talk, you'll see different connections to collaborations that are really informed by international travel. And the company's really been shaped by international travel. And in fact, just prior to COVID at IPAE, GSU led a conversation about climate and which really stuck in my mind all through COVID and led to Slingsby establishing a green touring model, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later on. But that's one example of collaboration and impact of international kind of engagement. And really, we're here now touring Ireland with our show, The Boy Who Talked to Dogs. And this show has come...
Slide.
Yeah, as you're watching yourselves. And we have the cast here. So this story, The Boy Who Talked to Dogs, comes from a memoir written by Martin McKenna. And now Martin is an Australian. He lives in Nimbin, but he grew up in Gary Owen in Limerick. And so there's kind of inherently a collaboration there between Australia and Ireland anyway. And Slingsby's been very fortunate in that since 2014, so the last 9 years, we've had the opportunity to tour within Ireland. And that's because in 2006, I was in Nykøbing Falster in Denmark and met this amazing person called Ema McGowan. So Ema and I had kind of worked together since then, and Ema worked really hard to bring Slingsby's work to Ireland. And then when I discovered the story of The Boy Who Talked to Dogs, I said to Ema, maybe this could be a collaboration between Slingsby and Dreyocht. And because Martin's story, even though he's an Australian and he's writing it from his living in Australia perspective, much of the story takes place in Ireland. The story really does take place in Ireland. And I guess that idea of collaboration within the company, like Quincy Grant, who's our composer. Quincy and I have been collaborating for the last 16 years. Wendy Todd, who's a designer we work with. You know, there is this idea of collaboration that's deep within the creative process of our company. And so I knew that if we wanted to tell a story that's set in Ireland, it's really not for an Australian playwright to tell that story. And fortunately, when we had been touring in Ireland in 2014 with The Tragical Life of Cheese Boy, I went to the Dublin Theatre Festival. Well, we were in the Dublin Theatre Festival, but I saw a work in progress showing of Luck Just Kissed You.
Hello.
which is one of Amy's works. Me being in Ireland allowed me to discover Amy's work. And I said to Ema, I think that Amy would be, you know, an amazing writer to approach. So that happened. And Amy luckily said yes. And then I had fallen in love with Lisa O'Neill's songs and as a singer-songwriter. So we asked Lisa if she would write some songs for the piece. And so then the next thing we did is we brought Lisa and Amy to Adelaide. And I think this was a really important step in the making of this work, was actually for us to spend time together. I know we have all found ways, and certainly Slingsby found ways during COVID to collaborate entirely via Slack or Zoom. But actually spending time together in a room is extremely important. And through that experience, we also brought Martin McKenna into the room, and so that was a collaboration as well, in that sense of discovering him. That changed the frame of the whole play, I think. But really, that time together was really critical. And then, of course, COVID hit, and we wound up having to work remotely anyway. Amy was writing the play. Prior to that, actually, we came back to Ireland with the young king, and we had a creative development as well. Actually, maybe it was while Emile was here. We had a collaboration with Brian Burrows. Emma had said, "Oh, I think you should meet Brian Burrows." Anyway, we had 3 days with Brian Burrows, and fell in love with Brian, as you will all see when you see the show. Why? So there is this very much this intercultural collaboration where we're an Australian theatre company telling a story that spans Ireland and Australia. But we have managed to have, I think, the same kind of collaborative process that in a way Quincy, Wendy and the whole team and the whole cast have had in Australia with Amy and Lisa, I think. So I'm going to handball it over to you now, Amy.
I don't quite know what else to say other than, yes, we were in Australia and we made the show. For this, I suppose I can only speak about this specific collaboration. And for me, actually, it did feel imperative to be in the room. It felt imperative whilst writing a story from an Irish voice. His life is very different, and I guess where he ended up is very different. So therefore, we had to be there to experience that. We had to be there to feel other, and we had to be there to garner an understanding as to how Slingsby work and like to tell stories, and see where my practice and Slingsby's practice meet, where they can meet and sit comfortably, and also spend time with Lisa. Lisa happened to be a friend of mine also, so that was nice. It was nice to be able to develop, I suppose, a shorthand with each other in the room, whilst also feeling like we were in it together. You know, where I think if we had done it over here, Lisa and I would have had, you know, we would have gone home and had a separate experience. But because we were living together in Adelaide, the work kind of continued all the time. And the playfulness of creativity continued all the time. And that kind of spunky spark, fed into the flavor of the piece, actually. And I'll just speak about this show. And I mean, yeah, it hasn't been on here yet, so you don't know what I'm talking about. But it's brilliant. And so I was asked to, if I'm going off topic, no, you can rein me in, Tony, if you want. That was my best Irish accent. you had a notion, you read the book and had heard Martin's story, and had a notion as to what it could potentially be. And then we went over to Australia and met Martin, and it became very clear to me very fast that the story that we were potentially talking about making didn't feel like the story. Would that be fair to say? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I said to Andy, and I think this is how... obviously, if you're having a collaboration, it's the trust within the artists and the people involved is imperative. And you have to kind of foster that and also ask for it and expect it on both sides. So I kind of turned to Andy and I said, I don't think that's the story. I think this is the story, which isn't quite as jazz handy. For the podcast, I'm doing hand movements as perhaps you potentially thought. So I think it's a little darker, and I think, to be honest with the story, and in reading the book also, I kind of thought what he's not saying is more interesting than what he is saying. So that became the story, and I said, I think it's a little darker, and I think it's probably for an older audience. And Andy went, I trust you, write what you want to write. So that was a real gift, actually, to be trusted like that. So therefore, yeah, so it kind of, I began writing it over there and it happened quite fast, which alarmed me. You know, you're used to kind of going, well, I was more used to kind of going, and when it's ready, it's ready. Or, you know, you're working to a deadline, but anyway, we'll have the first draft here and then we'll be over in 6 months. We'll workshop that. And then I was going, like, oh, Jesus Christ. But we did actually. And I think that, that helped a lot. And then we worked dramaturgically, over email. After the first draft and ticked away at it and arrived to what it is now. And then in working also with my working in collaboration with Lisa, who was doing the music for Lisa, who I think it's fair to say felt new to this process and new to this discipline. It was nice to have a shorthand with Lisa. We had a firm friendship, but having lived together and played together in Adelaide, for her to kind of go, can you just tell me what it is we're looking for? So it was nice to be able to work through it and kind of go, I think we need a song with this flavor. Mm. I think we need a lullaby here. I think we need a traveling song. I think we need a joy, you know, a song that makes us feel this, or a song that shows these colors for Martin, or, you know, so that's kind of how it all worked on my behalf. And then of course it was gorgeous. In one way, it felt quite strange, you know, for the show to be up and touring and have a whole life that you're not a part of. Normally, like in Ireland, as we know, the writer would be in the room for the rehearsals, and you know, you tweak and you change things as you're watching it. So it's harder to do that, obviously, from so far away. But it was quite joyous to then see it and see the dedication and the detail and the brilliance of every other artist involved in the piece, you know, like Quincy's music, Andy's beautiful direction, Wendy's stunning, stunning set, and the light, everything just worked beautifully. And then the musicians and to see how the character of Muso, again, like another more trust, Andy said it's a one person show, and I went, I need another person. It has to be another character, because there's no, if that's possible. To see how the piece bloomed and the scale to which it grew in my absence was quite gorgeous.
And I think that is the thing of collaboration. Like, you don't go into collaboration if you have a fixed idea of what you're going to make.
Yeah.
I think if you're going into collaboration, it's about an unfolding, a kind of a meeting and a journey of discovery together. And because there's multiple entities coming in, that you don't know how those ingredients are going to mix or how those personalities are going to bump up against each other. And so you have to be open and you have to say, we will find the answer together.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And I think if you don't go in with that sense of open heart and yes, then why collaborate? Like there's no point in doing it. It's not a collaboration. You know what I mean? So you have to be open for everyone else to bring more to the thing, or to make it better, or to put their stamp on it, because that's the whole point of doing it.
Yeah.
And I was saying to kind of Tony that the whole point is to bring what you can bring and to compromise without being compromised. And I feel that that's what we achieved in this. Yeah.
And I would just say as well, like this stories that span countries, we're currently working on another collaboration, which is with an Australian who is originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo and then lived in a refugee camp in Tanzania for 17 years before coming to Australia. And this is Rashidi Edwards' story. And Rashidi says that, you know, when we come to Australia, our story, our story becomes that part of Australia's history. Mm. And that's the truth of it. And that's why this, us working together to tell the story, was the right way to go.
Yeah.
There's a lot about that sense of the trust thing that goes on, but that trust, which is not just about going, oh, we just trust each other, it's that trust to go on difficult journeys, that trust to be able to actually have to learn about each other and go through those difficult things of actually going, as you say, it's not this, it actually needs to be this. And that ability to actually then go where it needs to go, rather than, no, we said it was going to be for 5 to 6 year olds. So this is where we're going to be stuck forever. You know, letting those things actually develop in their own way. What I'm wondering, in a sense, though, because you talk about that thing about the distances that you are physically apart from each other, how you actually develop those relationships when a lot of the time you're doing it online, and actually understanding that online sometimes it's actually quite difficult to actually have the kind of relationships that you have, as you talked about, when you're in the room together, where things suddenly then speed up. And I suppose, and it's just a sort of general thing about what are the positives of working remotely in that way? What are the positive things that you've learned from that experience? And maybe some of the things that you think you have to keep on looking out for as potential pitfalls in that kind of relationship.
I would just say that it feels like, it's almost like once you've met someone in person, once you've met them and shared something together, the online collaboration becomes 300% easier, I think. Because there's that kind of assumption, you know, when you say something that's a bit out of the box of where you're going, that you might go, what's that person kind of mean? And if you don't trust, if you're not able to go, I get you, and I get that what you're saying is something that has value and we're going to dig into it. Mm. If you're not, it's sometimes if you haven't had that time to meet each other, it's harder to kind of have that inherent trust, isn't it? Because you mentioned trust, and I think it's really important. It's hard. Do you feel like you've been able to develop that with people, with artists, without meeting?
I mean,
or do you feel like the room is essential for that? I guess
I like to think that the room is essential. However, you know, during COVID, we did also have a collaboration with Geordie Theatre in Montreal, and that was hybrid teams.
Okay.
So hybrid teams, design and composition team from Geordie Theatre and from Slingsby. So we created two teams, and we both set about trying to create full design development for imaginary productions. And we did it over a month. And actually, it really worked quite well.
Right, yeah.
We had a design presentation at the end of it. And so I did feel that we met, but it was sort of a fast-tracky thing, and we were making something we weren't really going to make. But it has potential.
I think it's nice to be in the room. I wonder, does it work well when it's part of the initial impulse to do it? You know what I mean? Like, I think it was part of the original idea. Well, we're going to work remotely and we're going to find a way through.
Yes.
So therefore, it can lend its... It's part of the concept.
Yeah.
But I think... It is best, in my experience and in my opinion, it is best to get a sense of who people are in real life and in the room, so you get a sense of their, again, artistic sensibilities, against a sense of also scale and ambition and also tone. Tone is really hard, as we all know, over text and email and everything. So that there can be no misunderstanding, and or if you get to know or trust a person, whether you like them or not, it doesn't really matter if you can work together. So therefore, when you and I like you, Andy. I'm not
saying. Yeah.
I'm really glad you said that.
But I think as well, like, so therefore, if you read something whereby you go, hang on, you can go, well, I like that person, and so I will employ my empathy to understand that in the way that I believe they meant to communicate that.
And then you can.
I don't like Quincy. I should say.
Yeah. Nobody does. But then we could have Zoom meetings and kind of talk through things.
Yeah,
as well,
like normal human beings, as opposed to being like obviously completely. Being polite, but without having to do the 10-minute dance before you kind of go look at this. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Yeah.
And remembering that we were all going through a global pandemic while we were having these conversations as well. So we were experiencing strange things. And I would just want to acknowledge and celebrate Brian Burrows, who, you know, when you see the production, Brian spent the first two weeks of rehearsals of this show in a quarantine hotel in Perth. You know, and so Quincy and I would get together in our hall and be on Slack with Brian, who was locked in a hotel room. And I mean, it turns out it's a great way to get actors to learn lines.
Nobody needs to get Brian Burrows to do anything, Major Singh. Have it done before you even suggest it.
But yeah, I mean, that was an extraordinary kind of situation. But we did find that it worked. But that's probably more down to Brian than anything else.
And Jess, picking it up, because you're doing a lot of this by yourself. So it becomes a different thing, in a sense, as a company, sort of working all the things and all the support that that can bring for doing these kind of collaborations. How do you find that process of you working remotely with people and, but also in different cultures and different countries as well?
My projects are always so different, but I feel like I'm collaborating when I land with my participants a lot. So I'm collaborating with children on the making of the I See You Like This portraits. And so I'm in the room, I guess, for the short time of that appointment, and that always works. But then when I went to Latvia, I landed there and I just couldn't believe how simpatico the team was there. It was like I was in, completely culturally different, but it was like I was in Australia. We just spoke the same language. I was given a writer, two actors and a composer and who else? Yeah, and a set and a costume designer, and had 3 weeks to get this show up. And it was amazing how instant the process was. So that felt fantastic. But there was no online collaboration there. I was able to come, I guess, and make it work without bringing my team. But I can't remember what the question was, Tony. Sorry, just went drifting off there.
It was a kind of vague one, so it's...
Yeah. Just say something about that.
One of the things I wanted to... is the journey of artists and yourselves in Australia, I know has been quite recently, or over the last number of years, is that whole thing about the stories that you can tell, who can tell stories, and actually the working with communities across your country, and that kind of relationship. And it's just actually touching a little bit on that, and how that has affected your work when you start to then work in other cultures and other communities.
So you mean like the original story and then that being taken to somewhere else?
Yeah, it's also about whose stories can you tell. It's that whole appropriation stuff. A bit, sort of touching on that thing about the power that we have all the time as white Europeans in different cultures and contexts, and that thing about you're actually working with cultures and communities across your country about those kind of developing relationships, which seems to be quite specific in some ways to a place like Australia and New Zealand as well, and how maybe that's affecting the work that you're doing when you take those things that you're learning into other places. Is that a dreadfully complicated question,
yes,
is it?
You might maybe, Andy, do you want to...
Yeah, I mean, I would say, yeah.
See if you reinterpret that into an actual question.
Very good.
If anybody else can work out what I actually meant there, they can tell me as well.
I'll try and sell a show while talking about it. I think it is that thing of... this is where collaboration is so valuable. I mean, so Slingsby... During the last 2 years, we had an ensemble of artists who were four days a week with the company, so we had an ensemble. And that ensemble included two First Nations Australian artists, an Ivan artist. And so we made work that reflected the personal stories and cultural connection of those artists. And that, I guess... meant that I had to do a lot of what I was doing when I was working with Amy and Lisa and Brian as well, which is I'm directing, so I'm supposed to be sort of managing the process, but I have to listen a lot. It's listening. I kind of think of it as leading through listening. And so facilitating those stories to make their way on stage, and I think Quincy would be doing that as well. So we made two productions with that ensemble, but most recently The River That Ran Uphill, which is Edgell Jr., who is a Niu Vanuatu man. It's his story of Cyclone Pam in 2015 and surviving that. And so he wrote down his story in Bizlama, and then his partner Sasha Zara, who works at Patch Theatre Company, translated that into English, and then we put that story on the stage. And Edgell thought that we were going to get a playwright to write a play, but instead we just went, no, well, we will all work together to put this show on stage. And I think that is a way to collaborate to bring other voices into the theatre and to bring to tell other stories, because it's not me telling that story, we're telling that story. And in fact, it's Edgell telling that story, but he has chosen to bring us on that journey to help tell that story. If that answers that. That question.
It was a rotten question, anyway. To be fair, so I think you've done. I think you've done incredibly well with it.
I could probably respond in a different way about. I guess I feel like I'm interested in the kind of stories that places tell, and whose stories are told about how that place is seen and. Whose experiences in that place are told. And so, yeah, I kind of am often interested in creating processes or creating concepts, I suppose, which make space for the kind of experiences and voices of a place that often are children, children's voices, yeah. Mm.
Do you find that that changes? Because it is such a universal piece, and I've seen it in different places, and it just works anywhere you put it. But what do you find when you're going to these different places? Can it be very, very different from place to place?
Well, I mean, I would say it's very different more from child to child, actually. It's kind of like remarkable often how different every single portrait is, even though there's pretty tight parameters around the process. And there's a kind of interview process that I do first with the parent and child, and those answers are always very diverse from child to child as well. But, you know, there's particularities that I find as well that are universal. It's very interesting. Like, there's this weird thing that started to emerge where five-year-old girls, the first thing they do if they're there with their dad is cover up their eyes with something, like stick something on their eyes. And I've seen it now happen in like four different countries. And so there's kind of things that are starting to emerge now that I've been doing the project for a long time that make me go, wow, there's some developmental relational things that I don't quite understand but are really interesting emerging. But I guess another thing about in Ireland, I noticed, children are quite gentle here, soft, very gentle with their parents, I noticed. So it's very interesting going into different places with a similar process and seeing what kind of responses you get. Yeah.
I'm just looking at time. I'm just wondering, would it be possible to bring the lights up on everybody so we can actually see? You can take the lights down on us and there you are. You all look fabulous
look
as well.
Look at them.
It's getting warmer too.
And it's getting warmer. So what we're going to do, I know, Aislinn, you were potentially wanting me to sort of say something a little bit about the Scottish experience or where we are at the moment.
Yeah, I suppose it's just, I suppose in Ireland we're, in terms of kind of sustainability and climate, we're a little bit behind, certainly Scotland and possibly Australia as well. It's something that I think a lot of us in the arts are very conscious of, our responsibilities, but there's very little up to now kind of guidance or policy or real concrete expectations, I suppose. I know it's coming down the tracks from places like the Arts Council, from the funding bodies, but I know that in Scotland you're further along in that, and I know that, you know, that that in Edinburgh and my colleague Hill, for example, they're working with carbon budgets and all of that. So it feels like it's a little bit more entrenched there, and it's certainly something that I think is going to be challenging here, but also welcome, because we know we have to embrace working in a different way so that we can continue to work internationally.
I think the key thing, and hopefully the thing that a conversation like this hopefully it sort of brings up is the need that collaboration is going to have to keep on happening. We're going to have to keep on finding ways to work with each other. And it's about finding those really, really interesting ways that we could actually do it. Because ultimately, it's about the art and the art form and actually being able to engage with audiences across the world in as interesting ways that you can. And it's actually, in a sense, going, this can be we can either go into a situation where we're going, well, we have to look at being carbon neutral by a certain period of time, and what do we do to actually do that? And then it becomes a challenge and a chore, and it becomes a hard thing to actually do. Or you can actually embrace it and actually go, well, what are the exciting things that we can actually do to actually keep on making work happen and to keep on allowing collaboration to happen? And I think that's the key thing that I think initially in Scotland, it might be the case, and we've got there's colleagues from England as well who I think would be in very much the same situation, that we all have to now have carbon things basically for everything that we do. That we have carbon trackers for everything. Every piece of journey that we do as a company has a carbon tracker next to it, so we can actually gauge everything that our organisation does. The interesting thing is, Jessica, you said 16.8, was that tonnes?
Tons per seat.
Tons per seat.
That's there and back.
Just to give you a little bit of a guide.
That's 16 would be a return trip.
Return trip.
But just to give you an idea, because we did our whole carbon thing, and so you basically every year with, we have Creating Carbon Scotland, you basically fill in a form saying this is how much you've used across the year. We did about 3 tours last year, ran a company full time. That one flight outdid us completely. Yeah. That one flight, that one return flight was more than everything that we did as a company.
Where was it to?
We were touring across Scotland. So we were touring across Scotland in trains, ferries, buses, taxis, and everything for a year, 3 tours. That one flight.
The flights would kill you.
The flight, does it.
I don't want to. I mean, why? What do you mean?
You're the tire, you win.
Jess wins. But the thing is, what we've learned, or what we've started to learn to do, I think, a lot more, and Imaginate have started to do this thing with Creative Carbon, so you actually have a chance to budget as well as record the stuff going on, is that it actually starts to become part and parcel of your process. And it starts to be that thing that when people are coming in at the start of the process, what you've got, and we can maybe touch on the green tour and guide, is that you actually start with everybody coming in and going, this is where we're going to try and be. This is what we're going to try and look at. We have an environmental contingency as part of our budget, and it means that what you're doing is encouraging people right from the very beginning to go try and make the environmental option every single time. When you're doing this, and it has really, really positive knock-on benefits as well. So we, last time round with the team, with the designers, were saying, right, we don't want to be building anything. We don't want to be buying things brand new. We don't want to be, we want to be looking at second-hand, found, all these things. We had a normal production budget in for the last tour that we did. We ended up spending a tenth of that. So it has, actually has really, really positive benefits for you as a company as well. It means your touring set then gets smaller. It means you become more nimble. It means you're potentially then able to actually tour to more places. And so when we think about the environment, we also are thinking about it in carbon impact, but we also have to think about it from the point of view of where you can actually access, because environment's also about access. If you live in one of the Highlands and Islands, in one of the remote islands, the impact now is that more ferries are being cancelled all the time up north because of what's happening with the climate. So that idea that children can actually access theatre and stuff like that all the time isn't true. So we have to again find ways to mitigate against that to allow us, which means that again we've got to build into our budgets the fact is that we actually might have to have a company sitting overnight somewhere and then actually touring there. So it's really trying to think about things in new ways. But once you start to get into that way of thinking it in a new way, it actually becomes quite exciting and quite positive about what you can actually achieve. And we are at a stage now where, with some of our touring, if we ever get funded again, by 2028 or 2029, Creative Carbon have come back and said you could be doing zero carbon tours.
Wow.
And that's something we actually go, but this is actually something that's really, really good to aim at. So the Green Touring Guide, it is coming, and all this stuff will be coming to people and to folk in Ireland. And I think the only thing I would say is just embrace it. really, really embrace it because we have to. So let's be creative and artistic about it.
You can also plant trees. So yeah. The agency I work with calculate roughly one tree per hour in the air. So that's a guide.
I would caution. Mm. I would just say I would caution against planting trees. It was an interesting thing because I thought, oh, that's fine. We can just offset everything.
Yeah.
The creative carbon folk came back and went, no, you can't. That's cheating. You have to make sure, again, it's like thing about how you embrace it. You've got to do things physically. You've got to do things. You can't just palm it off. And what I would say is if you're going that's to true. Offset in some ways, there are really, really interesting ways that you can actually do it. It doesn't have to be about planting trees, although the other way to look at planting trees is you can do rewilding, which is a different thing. You can get involved in, you know, setting up things where people are reintroducing beavers into Scotland, which has a massive impact in the environment. And there are schemes and things happening across the world which are about dealing with climate impact, which go above and beyond the thing about, you know, so you can be proactive in those ways as well. But I think just be slightly careful that when it comes to the creative carbon being neutral, there's a good chance that by simply saying, oh no, we just spend it on a forest somewhere, that actually won't count. It's like all these things, it's slightly complicated. And a bit nuanced, and you've got to find your own way with it as well.
Yeah, I mean, for Slingsby for the last 18 months, we've started to measure, which is our. So we're measuring. We do offset, but we double offset. So we buy trees from Trees for Life, and they get planted. But we also are working with Carl Winter-Telfer, who is a Mullawirra Mina man, a senior man, a Burka, who the Catholic Church 2 years ago handed back. 4 acres of property in McLaren Vale to him and his family, and so we're working with Carl to replant, to regenerate that. So we go and ourselves physically work with Carl to plant that, which will allow him and his family to return to sing song on country again. So that's part of that, and we know we're starting to get a picture now of what our carbon footprint is as a company, and definitely touring within Australia, you know, a tour across 6 states for The Boy Who Talked to Dogs was about 30,000 tons. The recent tour of Emile, which went to Hong Kong and Auckland and around Australia, was 130,000 tons. So we know what that cost is, and then we know what we need to do to offset that. The thing is, now we need to change the way we operate. So getting that information, and so our next project is 3 shows that will travel with 1 set with 1 cast, so that we instantly have a longer time in each place that we go to, deeper connection, but also reduced carbon expenditure for the amount of performance.
And this is where the dialogue becomes really, really important. I mean, we're just starting to do really, really simple things with touring. So instead of touring and just basically going wherever somebody would take you and you just travel on to the next place, what we started to do is to travel into an area and stay there for a week. And then you just do the thing that what you're doing is then traveling to your venues, whether they're local halls, venues or schools, and they're all within a 20-mile radius. So you're just doing simple stuff that starts to have that impact. You know, you're only staying in one place. The other major thing, which again, Creative Carbon were like, this is fabulous, is that you go to your audience. If you go to your audience, the carbon output just goes straight down. That thing about going into villages, that thing about taking shows into schools, into their communities, makes a huge impact, because what you're not doing is expecting your audience to travel from all over in various forms of transport to come to you. These are the kind of things that we are going to have to start to embrace more of as we go forward, and people are doing it, and I think it's just about that keeping that communication going so that we're learning from each other as much as we possibly can.